Chapter 5. More about memory. The topic of memory has already cropped up in various places in discussions about knowledge and activation. This chapter is accordingly about memory in both senses. Firstly, in the sense of knowledge, sitting stored in all or any one of the systems on both rings. And secondly, about the act of retrieving and using that knowledge. As so often, the language we use plays a crucial role in how we view such concepts. As was seen earlier, everyday notions like knowing something and knowledge being about facts and truths needed to be examined more closely in order to work out how our minds operate. The same is true of memory. Terms closely associated with memory like remember, recall, reminisce, call to mind can take on different meanings according to the context. We will continue with the extended meaning of the term memory to include both the storage and the retrieval. Also covered in this chapter are various subcategories of memory that have become standard in both academic and popular psychology. Okay, the act of remembering. Words like remember and recall suggest activities in the mind, activities in which memory plays a crucial part. Other expressions like he has a mind like a sieve or she has an amazing memory seem to refer more to memory as an ability or as a resource that can be drawn upon. If we take the act of remembering on a particular occasion first, this refers both to the deliberate use and spontaneous unsolicited use of some stored knowledge. You try to decide to remember something, or a memory just pops into your head. Either way, it is also associated with the notion of past. In such contexts, it is always a conscious experience, whether the remembering is deliberate or whether it is unsolicited or somehow just happens. At any rate, remembering provides us clear evidence that something in our heads has been stored and can, in principle, be retrieved. The subconscious use of memory. Remembering, however, is not the only way that memory operates in our daily lives. Consciousness, you may remember, as important as it is, can only occupy a tiny fragment of our ongoing mental activity. One important reason for this, you may remember, is that any increase in activation involves increasing in energy consumption. That is, for the mind and brain alike. Keeping things as much as possible at relatively low subconscious levels is much more energy efficient. Another reason, and without going now into the technical details, is that at the very high levels of activation required for consciousness, at any given moment, only one thought at a time can claim our attention. This makes thinking relatively ponderous, with one thought having to follow another in a sequence, a kind of one thing at a time principle. We might argue that of course we can think of two things at the same time, but in fact this only means that we can keep both thoughts in a state of activation, of high activation, and juggle rapidly between one and the other. In fact, the process of storing and activating existing representations from different stores is going on all the time, and it's going on whether we are conscious of it or not. Moreover, unlike conscious processing, when we are engaged in thinking, subconscious processing does enable us to carry out many tasks at the same time. We do this by definition without giving a single thought to what we are doing and what knowledge we are relying on. A particularly striking example of the subconscious use of memory, or as we might put it simply, the subconscious use of our existing knowledge, is when our mind seems to be making decisions. Something that we might assume is only carried out consciously. In other words, while we're putting together an assessment of someone, or of someone, consciously, at the same time, subconscious processes are working in a way that can bias that conscious assessment. For example, people on an appointments committee interviewing someone for a job throughout the interview may well very consciously feel that they are following an agreed, rational and fair assessment process. However, despite their best intentions, they may actually make up their minds subconsciously about that candidate after only 5 minutes have elapsed. As the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman has claimed, much decision-making happens not after a careful rational process had taken place, but rapidly on the basis of hidden cognitive biases. These biases will have been established already for various reasons, and part of that process will certainly include combined memories of people and situations in the past that will be relevant and subtly affect the interviewer's judgment. Knowing this, of course, is unsettling for most of us. After all, we want to be in control of what we decide or do not decide. In the appointments interview example, we may indeed remain totally confident that we have followed a fairer procedure until the very end of the interview. On other occasions, we may become aware that although we had the firm intention of doing one thing, we somehow ended up doing something else that we didn't want to do. This apparent loss of control over our actions can be unsettling, but it is very human. On the positive side, remember the mind is doing an enormous amount of work on behalf without bothering us. We should give it a break sometimes. Being conscious and having to control all of that otherwise subconscious work would slow down our mental activity down to a pace that even the slowest sloth or sloth would find slothful or slothful. And this apart from the little matter of driving us insane. Long-term memory. All the representations that spend some time existing in our various knowledge stores, visual knowledge, conceptual knowledge, and so forth, and which have been accumulating over our lifetime as a result of experience, might be thought of collectively as making up what in the psychological literature is commonly called our long-term memory. Note that when you recall or remember something, people usually mean stored knowledge that has been sufficiently activated for it to become conscious. If the activation levels associated with knowledge are still not quite high enough, we may get that tip-of-the-tongue experience referred to earlier. In such cases, the complete set of details of what we would regard as being a memory still in our possession continue to elude us, even though we are aware of having it in our possession, and even though we can frustratingly call just a few of the details, but not enough to bring it completely to mind. Long-term memory is a readily understandable description of what is in a store. Memory as storage is also a description regularly used in information technology for stored digital information, for example, random access memory, memory stick, flash memory, and so on. Summing up so far, when we refer to our memory in general, we are referring to a perceived ability to construct, retain, and activate knowledge representations. We have many everyday ways of referring to memory and remembering. For example, we can say things like, "She has an amazing memory," or, "I have a terrible memory," or, "He has a great memory for details," or, "I have a terrible memory for people's names." All these expressions can be translated into the terms of this book as statements about representation, storage, and activation. With the conceptual, the meaning store, and its multiple associations with other stores playing a central role. At the same time, having said that remembering must be a conscious process, it is of course also true to say that in some contexts people, especially psychologists, do talk of subconscious memories. This clearly refers to those associative schemas that are activated enough to affect our thoughts and behaviour, but not sufficiently for us to become aware of this influence, as in the above example of the biased interviewer. However, perhaps more frequently they're referring to disturbing events or memories that have become hidden, and which some therapists might want to bring to the surface to aid the healing process. In any case, we now say that on closer examination, then, memory is not such a simple, straightforward concept as we might have imagined. Memories as schemas. Following on from what was said earlier, the representations that make up what we regularly refer to as our memories are best seen as being composed of those one or more representational networks, in other words, schemas. Schemas involving more than one system. Memories of one particular person or several persons together, or places or events, for example, would always come in the form of schemas. Those schemas involve associations between representations in many stores, such as conceptual representations, identifying people and places and times, but also emotional associations and sensory ones as well, just to give you a few examples. Language, and hence the systems responsible for linguistic structure, is often involved as well, especially where the memory schema centres around particular words or phrases, different ways of expressing some meaning, or particular characteristic ways in which people known to the individual or groups of people happen to speak or write. The schemas become live memories whenever the representations that they are composed of are co-activated intensely enough, making us aware of them. It is perhaps most useful to think of remembering as the activation of particular meanings, in other words, conceptual. These meanings will sit at the centre of a spider's web of schemas that link them up both with other meanings in their own conceptual store, but also with, for instance, sights and sounds and feelings located in other stores. The simplified orange example already demonstrated this idea of schemas centred around the conceptual hub, with links radiating out all over the place to other stores. When we are busy remembering something, or when we recognise something as familiar, these activated representations will often include a meaning which relates them to a particular time. This is their timestamp that identifies them collectively as belonging to some point or period in the past that is either precisely or imprecisely specified. As indicated above, psychologists divide up memory into different categories, like episodic memory, encyclopedic memory, and there are a few other categories that feature frequently in the media, like sensory memory and muscle memory. We covered the terms declarative and procedural in the previous chapter, and these two terms are also applied in the psychology literature to two types of memory. But all of these different types can be interpreted as being based on how knowledge activation and knowledge schemas work in general. All of this follows the basic line of thinking developed in the preceding chapters and illustrated in a very simple fashion in Figure 7. Declarative schemas are based on conceptual representations that can be activated to levels intense enough to feature in our thoughts, our conscious thoughts. The way they do this will be elaborated in Chapter 10. Procedural schemas, by definition, solve tasks below the levels of activation required for awareness and need not involve conceptual representations. Take, for example, the body of an athlete that will move spontaneously in the way in which it has been fully trained to move without any need for the conscious control that might once have been involved during the training period. Only then can skillful performance work, leaving athletes' thinking space free to, for example, monitor the execution of some carefully thought-out strategy during a competition as it's taking place. There is a story about a centipede who was once asked if each of its pairs of legs moved backwards and forwards together in synchronized fashion, or perhaps did they move as a human would walk, first one of them forwards and then the other one. The centipede, asked this question, scratched its head with one of its legs and said, "Well, I have never given a single thought to how I walked. Let's see now." It then proceeded to walk forwards at the same time, trying very consciously to feel which way its feet actually moved. What then happened for the first time? It fell over. When, following an act of remembering, the activated representations marked as belonging to past time become inactive again, they will continue to exist as inactive. Hence, we think of these schemas as continually in existence, even when dormant, in other words, as memories or remembered knowledge. They may also at times resist recall, in which case we think of them as there but not currently accessible, and we blame it on tiredness or something else getting in the way, or they are felt to be knowledge that now appears to be lost or forgotten for good. It is an open question as to whether whole memories remain with us despite being inaccessible for long periods, or whether important parts of such memories can in fact dissipate completely and so undermine the coherence of the schema that carried them. To adapt a phrase from a poem by William Butler Yeats, part of which was famously used by Chinua Achebe for the title of his magnum opus, we could say, "Memories fall apart, the centre cannot hold. Memories fall apart, the centre cannot hold." The central position of the conceptual system as a crossroads through which many connecting lines between stores in the schema pass through might be seen as the centre that cannot hold. If the meaning parts of a schema are affected, the meanings at the, in the centre of the hub, as it were, of the schema, the whole memory might well fall apart or at least fade. In such cases, we would be tempted to think of the memories referred to as being genuinely forgotten, and by that means that they are literally no longer present, either in our minds or by our extension of brains, in our brains, because of this lost piece of meaning information. The fact that all memories that have been long forgotten can still re-emerge in old age raises that intriguing possibility we touched on earlier, namely that nothing or almost nothing is ever really completely forgotten, and the associations that make up the original schema can be revived in some way under given circumstances. This notion will be returned to shortly in connection with memory and aging. Working memory. Activation brings representations into a state which is called working memory. This important concept does have a special status that makes it stand out compared to many of the other familiar psychological categories mentioned earlier. Working memory is not a special store or a location, but a particular state in which the mind is during mental processing. A simple definition of working memory would be the state that any representation is in when it is currently activated. In short, working simply means activated memory. Activating knowledge. This definition, therefore, must also describe representations that have been activated but not to a sufficient degree that would trigger awareness. So anything that is activated to some degree is in working memory by definition. When your mind engages with some task, various representations, and usually many, will be co-activated in and across their respective stores. Strictly speaking, then, active memory, in other words, working memory, consists of types of representations now activated within their respective stores, right? In each respective stores, they're activated. That's to say, in the store's working memory. And secondly, is the outcome of all the existing associations, not just within their particular stores, but also between representations in other stores, and now causing all these representations to be activated in sync as part of a schema. In other words, those representations are all partners in the schema at large, and they come from different working memories, different stores. Using the metaphor of colour, if all the activated representations in your mind were thought of as being in different shades of red, you know, a pale red would be activated to some small degree and very red to a high degree, and all the other dormant ones would be in blue, then your current working memory would be the red parts of your mind at a particular moment in time. If you wish to extend that moment to, say, 60 seconds, you could imagine the red and blue areas continually changing as the milliseconds whiz by. This idea is a highly simplified version of what would appear on a colour screen when the brain is scanned for the same 60 seconds. By its very nature, then, the period when the representations are in a working memory state lasts for very short periods, and that can be as little as a few milliseconds. This is because while there may be possibly representations that are permanently active to some degree, activation is overwhelmingly a temporary phenomenon. Once a given task is complete, most and sometimes all representations involved would return to their resting state. However, since the mind executes many tasks at once, it would be hard to discover even a part of a millisecond where the mind is in a completely blue state. If it was, you might begin to worry about it. Limited capacity. Many researchers believe that the number of representations in working memory at any particular moment will be restricted due to it having a limited capacity. In other words, there is a limit on how much you can activate and keep active at any one time. In the perspective adopted in this book, this idea of limited capacity also needs to be related to the individual stores along with their processors. It may be, for example, that there is no limit in principle on the number of representations that can be activated in a particular store, but that an explanation for how much can be activated at any one time should be sought elsewhere, for example, in the way working memory is somehow organized at a higher level to carry out some particular task, that is, coordinating what happens currently to be jumping up and down in the working memories in a range of different stores. We must always assume, for example, that the mind's biological machine, in other words, the brain, must have a limited capacity of energy to support the activation of representations in general, but how that energy is distributed by the biological software remains an open question. The mind's capacity to evaluate what at any instant is more important or less important as the milliseconds tick by, and to direct the energy in that direction, is probably where the solution lies. The common pool idea of memory would all be referred to later in Chapter 10 when describing a state whereby representations activated in the working memory of different systems, in different stores that is, behave as though they had been drawn from a common store. An example. Oranges again. Take the orange example. Not such a simple one as it turns out. The meaning of orange as represented in the conceptual store will be a complex representation already, constructed via experience as a set of associations between different representations, starting with other in-house representations, that is, within the same conceptual store, such as, for example, the concepts edible and fruit. So there'll be a lot of concepts which will be bundled together to make the conceptual representation of an orange, or oranges in general. A foretaste of this complexity was displayed in the previous chapter in Figure 4. There will also be multiple external associations with representations of other types, right? We're sitting for the moment in the conceptual store, but now there will be multiple external associations with representations of other types. In other words, in other stores, dealing, for example, with smell, taste, appearance and touch, meaning and value. The basic processing operations involved remain pretty simple. A representation, once activated, will immediately co-activate all the other ones with which it has become associated, its partners, as it were, in the schema, including those in other stores. This is what is meant by an activated schema. That network of representations in Figure 4, once activated, would be an example of such a schema, although this is really only a simplified version of what a typical orange schema or many other schemas would look like. Inactive schemas. Once networks of association have been formed in the mind, the resulting schemas will not just disappear, but then continue to exist once everything in the schema has returned to its respective resting levels. Their various connections and all their component representations can easily be activated together on subsequent occasions. It is easy to see that mental activity, even over a short space of time, involves myriads of these schemas. They will get triggered, driven independently from ongoing processes within the mind, but also in response to external stimuli coming from the world outside. Suppressed memories. When engaging with traumas and similar distressed states of mind, psychologists often tell of memories being suppressed. This frequently occurs subconsciously, whereas schemas that have been inactive for a long period will eventually undergo a substantial decline in their resting levels, and hence accessibility, certain events may undergo a much swifter process because the individual finds the memory of them intolerable. These will involve traumatic or extremely unpleasant events that have caused great distress. There are arguments about the pros and cons of engaging in therapeutic interventions that stimulate the recall of such events and hence break through the suppression process. In any case, the notion of rapid memory suppression needs an explanation. This is probably the result of the mind effectively placing a taboo on the schema responsible for representing the distressing events. This placing of a taboo will be the affective system at work in collaboration with the conceptual system. The schema, which will already have a strong negative association anyway, which basically says harmful. Any schema containing this representation as part of its complete network of associations will therefore trigger avoidance strategies. This response may well be part of the combined biological starter set that we begin life with, whereby the mind will instinctively avoid what may harm it. However, avoidance can take different forms. So, not just the avoidance of becoming repeatedly aware of past traumas. A conflict naturally arises between, on the one hand, the harm that memories of traumatic experiences can cause to an individual's quality of life and mental stability, and, on the other hand, the general potential that such experiences have for being useful in future, i.e., creating accessible, unsuppressed knowledge that will permit the construction of effective, but now conscious, avoidance strategies whenever the individual feels it is needed. In such situations, the individual takes back conscious control. Since every individual is different, the therapist will have to work out what the most effective overall strategy is for that individual. Flexible adaptive responses. If mental activity in the vast subconscious is a jungle, with many things competing against one another, it is clearly a world in which many things are going on simultaneously. When a particular scheme of associations is activated, it will not be a simple question of one schema being triggered after another. Any number of schemas will also be competing with one another at any given moment. During this activity, any schema may undergo modifications. It may be expanded or modified in some way in response to ongoing experience. This means that the activated schema is no longer the same as it was when it was initially activated, and the associated representations that it is composed of will be now in some modified state when they now fall back to their various resting levels. The picture of mental activity that I've here sketched stresses its enormous complexity and its dynamic character as the mind continually responds to ongoing experience. At the same time, paradoxically, while the results at any given moment involving many representations and many associations can be very complex indeed, the basic processing principles driving all this complex activity are simple enough. They apply to all the mind systems without exception. Briefly stated, they are as follows. Activation on any occasion is always a matter of degree, and the current resting levels of representation mark how established they have become, and therefore how likely their involvement in any particular task will be. Associations are formed between representations in different stores in the form of associated schemas. Which schemas get to operate in the execution of tasks with which the mind is continually faced will be decided by competition. The current competitiveness of individual representations and their schemas will be influenced initially by how high or how low their springboard is currently placed, in other words, their current resting level. Then, whichever schema gets to dominate in the competition at any particular moment in time ultimately depends on what the mind makes of the current context. This renders certain activated representations and schemas currently more highly valued than the others. Since the general context is constantly in flux, values will change in response to changing circumstances. In this way, the mind always responds flexibly to the way in which it interprets the circumstances of the moment, adjusting the values of different parts of any activated schemas accordingly. To visually appreciate the amazing adaptability of the mind, it is best not to focus your attention so much on the static picture presented by the mind's metro map, with all its stations spaced neatly around the two rings, the inner and the outer ring. Instead, focus on the ongoing, frantically competitive activity of the intricate networks of association that link up items in its 11 stores. Forgetfulness in later life. In line with what was mentioned in the previous chapter about forgetting, as representations become more accessible by virtue of them being frequently activated, so too knowledge that remains unused for long periods can gradually undergo a decline in its resting levels. In other words, a representation and all the associations between given representations that together make up a particular memory schema will become gradually less competitive. In other words, they will become harder to access. In this way, you may forget words, names, visual memories of places you once visited, directions to locations that have not yet been required for a long time, and so on and so forth. Down go the resting levels, and as a result, other things that are more frequently used get in the way. Old skills seem to weaken and even fade away completely. The mind appears to work on the basis of efficiency, so that infrequently activated representations and schemas of representations undergo a decline in their resting levels. These can only be revived by resuming their frequent use. The use-it-or-lose-it principle works for the most part, although in later years, as a result of the normal aging process, the manner in which recently acquired representations decline appears to change, such that more frequent use than was the case before is now necessary to maintain their competitive level, because things get forgotten more quickly. This, at least, is one interpretation of the aging process. Another interpretation would have something to do with overcrowding by too many competitors caused by the sheer number of stored representations and associations that have accumulated over the long lifetime. Another factor might be a slower rate at which new representations are formed and develop high resting levels in response to repeated activation. Or it might be some combination of a number of different factors. More and more items in storage will certainly mean more items competing with one another on particular occasions. One phenomenon experienced in later life are long-forgotten people and events resurfacing in people's minds of their own accord, that is, without any apparent reason. Renewed access to representations that have not been achieved and not been activated for some considerable time should not happen without something new occurring to cause it. At any rate, the fact that long-forgotten events and situations are revived brings into question the issue of whether anything is really completely forgotten, such that it is extinguished completely from whatever store or stores it occupies. What changes, then, are the current values of the representations involved? Again, the explanation for this revival of memories can be traced back to the important role of the affective system. The most plausible conclusion seems to be that memory loss may well be much more a matter of losing access to representations than a complete extinction of the representations and schemas themselves. One striking example of the persistence of representations in their stores comes from the linguistic literature. Long-time Dutch immigrants in Australia in their later years were studied by the linguist Michael Klein. They were, to their great surprise, experiencing their native Dutch coming back to life when they had fully accepted it had long been completely lost. The apparent restoration in old age of resting levels of activation to competitive levels challenges the use-it-or-lose-it principle, if, that is, by lose-it is meant extinguish it completely. Insights from neuroscience also seem to suggest a link between the lowering of resting levels and the action of inhibiting neurotransmitters, the primary one being gamma-aminobutyric acid, known as GABA, G-A-B-A. However, age-related changes in the action of these neurotransmitters is a complex issue, not as easily linked both to the observable decline in memory and its revival. The way to preserve the general principle that inactivity always leads to decline in resting levels is by relating this surprising re-emergence of long-forgotten memories to a separate process which had already been briefly mentioned. And this has to do with associations with value representation in the affective store, associations that were already discussed in connection with suppressed memories. It comes down to saying that any representation that becomes associated directly or indirectly with high negative or positive value in the affective store will have its activation level boosted, and hence be better able to outcompete other representations that might be competing with it. This means, in effect, that old associations which have lost their value over time begin to acquire higher values, which will then boost their resting levels back to a point where they start to become accessible again. A contributory cause underlying this resurgence of events in the distant past is that individuals simply start thinking about the past more frequently, and activation consequently starts to spread, finding its way to dormant memory schemas that have hitherto not been stimulated in this way. Not recently, anyway. This would fit, then, the simpler activation account of memory we have been relying on thus far. With the past assuming a greater value over the present, older individuals, then anything associated with the past accordingly acquires a more positive value. This is especially true of still remembered pleasant memories, but even of memories of unpleasant situations, which the passage of time has rendered more distant, and so less negative and less harmful. Spreading activation will ensure that the schemas involved in past memories do gradually begin to experience an overall rise in their resting levels, and those memories begin to return. The contents of the original schemas, which had become somewhat threadbare and fragmented, now begin to undergo restoration, as more past situations become accessible again. You might argue that frustrating memory failures in old age that are related to everyday life in the present are, to some degree, compensated for by this reminiscent effect, with the individual's faded past history becoming fresh again. There is some evidence that this could be exploited to stimulate the cognitive abilities in the aged in the present. For example, an experiment whereby the subjects were provided with accommodation that replicated their lives as lived many years earlier turned out to have boosted both their mental and physical abilities. Research like this continues to place the role of the affective system in the spotlight. Chapter summary. This chapter has tried to reconcile various approaches to memory in psychology and also neuroscience by relating various standard categories of memory in psychology to general principles of cognition. These involve activation and the creation of associated schemas. It was possible to relate the basic categories often used in connection with memory to the two main ones. Long-term memory then becomes a synonym for all stored representations, whether or not they are active or dormant, while working memory, as the term implies, is defined as just the currently activated representations. Working memory is then a state in which the mind happens to be when the process, when in the process of working on given tasks. The mind is constantly working on more than one and often many tasks at the same time. In each case, representations are being activated that will be get out-competed as the best fit for the task is settled on. In general, other things being equal, representations that have a low resting level will struggle to participate in the task when stronger candidates are around. They will need their levels to get boosted somehow if they have any hope of winning the competition in the future. Long inactive representations will tend to have ever-decreasing resting levels, making them appear to have been lost. Different types of memory, such as episodic memory, encyclopedic memory, and so on, can be explained as different types of schema based on meanings, i.e. conceptual representations. Different schemas involving representations in different stores will obviously be reflected in different patterns of neural activity, such that patterns associated with one type of memory might well be distinguishable with patterns of another. The same is true of declarative memory and procedural memory. The implicit-explicit distinction that also surfaces in discussion of memory will be held over to the chapter on consciousness. There was also a brief discussion of forgetting phenomena, especially with respect to older individuals. Sometimes circumstances change and old memories can resurface. In particular, old age typically appears to be characterized by a general resurfacing of old memories, and an explanation for this phenomenon was given in order to deal with the apparent difference that arises between the explanation of resurfacing memories in the aging mind and accounts of the same phenomenon in the aging brain. And that is the end of this chapter.